WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Steve, what do you think the significance of this tour is?
Well, it probably has many more dimensions than could be stated simply. There are dimensions of significance for the performers leaving their country, coming to another place, performing for large numbers of people rather than in a traditional setting where there's just the members of the immediate tribe around and so forth. But I'd say the greater political and musical significance perhaps is that this is part of a reversal of both policy and attitudes towards Aboriginal Australians by the Australian government. In the last 10 years, a number of efforts have been made to reverse what was a very unenlightened history of ways of dealing with and ways of conceptualizing what Aboriginal Australians were about as people, just declaring them primitives and so forth. It was an attitude which directly went along with a kind of elite racism and a policy that was leading to genocide on the part of the Australian government. I think there's guilt about that in Australia. And at the same time, there are some enlightened people who would really like to do something decent about it, not just by dictating, we know what's good for you people to do, but letting the people speak for themselves in a sense. And that's taking place along a number of dimensions. One is linguistically. There's now a school for Aboriginal Australian languages where Aboriginal Australians are being trained as linguists so that they can be the ones who are directly involved in writing down their own languages, developing teaching materials, preserving the oral traditions of their society in a written form, rather than just having an occasional outsider, an anthropologist or a missionary coming and copying some of these things down. So that the initiative is now being developed by Australians. And one of the people who we hear on the tape is, in fact, a linguist and has been doing this.
I know that in this tour there's been a lot of effort to ensure that the Aboriginals themselves are controlling to the degree that you can maintain control on a tour of the what's presented and how it's presented. But, for instance, in the tape that we're going to hear, when we were in the studio, I knew that when I say something like, can you do a song for us, that in their own communities, that song wasn't going to be done in this kind of context at all. And I wasn't even sure I had the right language to use to describe the way music would function for them. It's not, hey, do a tune for us. Can you talk a little bit about the way music works in Aboriginal society?
Well, I think the first thing is to say that every community, every Aboriginal community, would have quite a number of cycles of songs and stories, and they deal with many different kinds of topics. There's no really one kind of song or one kind of tune or even one kind of scale or instrument or whatever. The largest sort of difference that we could trace, which I think is generalizable to all Aboriginal communities, is between traditional songs which come out of the oral tradition and were composed by ancestors long ago in what is called the dream time, and those which are new songs or songs which have been composed within living history or memory and are related to specific events, people, actions, feelings, aspects of the environment, and so forth. Now, in this oral tradition, these dreamtime songs, they are private and they are secular and they're sacred, and they're in large cycles. These legends are simultaneously creation stories. They explain and describe political systems. They describe and delineate the need for established obligations, ceremonies, social responsibilities, rituals, and things like that. Those are private. Those are not the things that you hear these people sing about, either on the tape or in public performance. Those are sung as, say, parts of initiation, parts of private events. Then there are the more recent songs, things which have been composed by specific individuals in living memory, related to particular events of some importance. And sometimes those are also sung in series or in cycles of several connected songs. One of the things which I noticed at the performance on the Parkway was that the songs were short, of course, because they were part of cycles.
Yeah,
and
there
would
I
be
noticed
a minute
that too,
long,
a minute long
or something like that, and people would stop and clap in between them. Well, of course, there's nothing like that in the original context. The pauses, the silences are particularly meaningful. So the clapping, to me, was a kind of disruption in a way, as a sort of arbitrary breaking up of the events. The fact that the songs are short is something that was always remarked upon by writers about Aboriginal music, and it was one of the reasons why they always said it was simple and primitive. Of course, nothing could be less the case. I mean, there are many poetic and song forms throughout the world where precisely the aesthetic is to do a lot in a very short period of time. Witness haiku, for instance. So the fact that the songs are short is in no way an indication of their simplicity.
The instruments that we'll be hearing on the tape are boomerangs, wooden boomerangs, which are clapped together, wooden sticks, which are also clapped together, and a didgeridoo, which is the sound that'll probably be most unusual to our ears. Can you explain the instrument and how it's influenced Western musicians, like jazz musicians, for instance?
The technique of playing the instrument is, in fact, a very complicated technique, one that has just reached the West very recently, called circular breathing or bellows breathing, in which the player will puff out his cheeks, creating a reservoir of air, and be able to play a continuous tone without stopping for a breath by drawing air in through the nose as they're playing. People who've listened to Clark Terry or Rahsaan Roland Kirk know that this is something which became very fashionable in jazz in the 1960s, and it's something which is really a mark of virtuosity among Western musicians, or it's been traditional in Australia for 30 or 40,000 years, and also in other parts of the world. Witness, for instance, in India, where the flute players play with circular breathing and so forth. The other technique which is most interesting with the didgeridoo is the vocal polyphony. That is, they will be playing a fundamental pitch and at the same time hooting, singing, or making other sounds into the instrument at the same time. And that, again, is now considered in the West a virtuoso technique. We have avant-garde composers in the last 10 or 15 years writing pieces for trumpet, trombone, and tuba where players have to simultaneously play a note and sing a note into the instruments. So these things, which are now considered avant-garde or virtuoso techniques in the West, are things which have existed in this music for a very long time and which are done expertly by Australian didgeridoo players.
Do you see any similarity, Steve, between how America and the American government, the American people, have dealt with Native Americans and what's happening in Australia or has happened in Australia between the white people, the government, and the Aboriginals?
Well, of course, the histories are very different, and the last 200 years in America and the last 200 years in Australia have a great number of differences. But to mention just a few of the similarities, there's been a tremendous amount of cultural destruction. And a lot of that has been through the destruction of languages and the destruction of poetries and the destruction of music and the destruction of expressive forms, things which embody some of the sentiments which are really at the heart of these traditional societies. It's estimated now that there were 200 distinct traditional languages spoken by about 600 tribes in Australia in traditional times. Of those, maybe 100 are spoken today, and only 50 of those with some regularity. Well, like in America with Native American languages, the Australians developed schools, put the Aboriginal people in schools and broke up the language groups, broke up the tribal groups deliberately as a way of breaking down the societies. And you have the same kind of situation in America. Think of the popular image of the Indian in America, you know, Tonto, and this kind of pigeonized English, me talk like this kind of stuff. Well, you have the same attitude about Aboriginal English. But here it's really, as in America, the burden of the whites. They first went and taught these people this horrible, ungrammatical, ridiculous form of the language. Then when the people spoke like that, they turned around and laughed at it and said, see, they can't speak English. And we have the same kind of destruction. There are also some similarities, I think, in terms of the politics of whether people live on reservations or whether they're considered part of a national political situation. And but as I say, in the last 10 years, things are making a lot of turns for the better, I think, in Australia. And it's also aided by the fact that there are now some very good and very competent people who are working with the community and who have not just their own egos and their own careers and so forth in mind, but are working to help Aboriginal people present their society on its own terms.
Just a word about culture shock. I think there's a lot of it that happened when they were in town and happened here in the studio also. Their culture shock will probably come through on the tape, and they're not used to big cities,
right,
or traffic or any tall buildings, any of the stuff that they found here. But then again, neither am I or the other people here used to people walking in with body paint on, wearing loincloths and things like this. So any advice about dealing with the innate culture shock that happens when people from incredibly different cultures suddenly come together?
Well, I think there's an immediate tendency, to sort of romanticize this and say, wow, look at this. I mean, it is very different. On the other hand, there are some very simple things. I noticed on the tape that they kept talking about how hot it was. Well, it's winter in Australia now, so just this immediate move from a place where it's very cold to a place where it's very hot. I mean, airplane travel for 12,000 miles, and in 24 hours you're in another place, and it's hot. I think those kinds of things are really noticeable to those people because they live much closer to their environment than we live to our environment, and that sort of stuff affects them a lot. So those kinds of remarks that they make, and also living in a tall, high-rise building while they're staying here. For us, I think that maybe the important thing is to try and see past the loincloth and body paint and all of that kind of business and not deal with it as a Disney cartoon, but as a living expression of a group of people who are not coming here to to do something particularly prophetic or great or to make themselves into something that's high art in a concert sense, but to say very simply and very directly, this is what we do at home, and this is how we do it. I mean, the Parkway is not the desert of Australia, but nevertheless, this is what we do. Just listen to it and think about it and listen to what we have to say about it, and maybe you'll really learn something about a very different way of organizing the world and thinking about it.
Thanks, Steve. You set up a lot of concerts in Australia. So what are your goals when you're setting up a concert about bringing different groups of people together? And what kinds of musical introductions are you trying to make?
Well, I'm afraid our first goal is to... we're really working for the people that control the company that I manage, which is called the Aboriginal Artists Agency. It's just a little non-profit corporation. You'd referred to it in America. And the people that control it, they would rather see... Aboriginal people get some exposure on the Australian media and on television and so forth in a way that was not degrading to the culture. That's our prime, that's our main sort of idea. So, I mean, there are endless ways in which people have exploited Aboriginal culture. I mean, there's certain performers who are white who play didgeridoos. There are all sorts of funfair acts which are associated with Aboriginal culture and which the Aboriginal people themselves find rather offensive. So this agency is a new idea to try and combat those rather horrible versions of the culture with something real.
Mm-hmm. But is the music that it gets played at concerts and the music we're going to be hearing today, music that would ordinarily be played as like part of a ceremony or, I mean, are people used to performing concerts?
Now, the only way they perform concerts is when I set them up in the optimum conditions for them to play what they would play at home. And that's why on this tour, you'll notice we haven't agreed to play inside anywhere, and we haven't agreed to play in the morning. I mean, we play in the evenings the way people would at home, outside, on sand, if at all possible, which is still a big compromise, but it's, you know, it shows that that there are principles you can follow which will make people understand the culture better.
There's some music that's secret and some music that's public. I guess what we'll be hearing is mostly the public music.
Yes, if you start with the premise that the people themselves will control the culture better than any other entrepreneurs, then you don't have this problem because the people themselves will decide whether they're going to play you secret music without telling you or public music. But either way, you won't be offending anyone. If you, as the anthropologists have done in good faith, recorded secret ceremonies and then end up broadcasting them as part of a talk or something, they often run into a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we can hear some music, and let me say hello to the musicians who are joining us also. Maybe I'm trying to think of what the best place would be to start. Maybe you can explain what the didgeridoo is, and then we could hear a little bit of didgeridoo music. It's a sound that I think will sound a little familiar to our listeners, but it's an instrument that is probably unfamiliar. Anthony, do you want to explain the instrument?
Yeah, well, it's pretty simple. It is actually a eucalypt, which has been hollowed out by the action of termites. And people cut them to different lengths for a slightly different note. So what most people think when they see them is that it's going to be a rather dull sound because it only makes one note. But then with the manipulation of the tongue and the breath patterns, you can get overtones. And, of course, there's rhythm as well in there, which is produced by the musician.
So Jackie Nulawiti is playing the didgeridoo, right? Jackie, can you just play the didgeridoo a little? Just give us a sense of how it sounds. And can I ask you also, John, to sing now with it?
Yes.
Really enjoyed that. John, what was the song about that you just sang?
It's about a bird which is called Brolga In our tongue, it's called gororko, which is a big, long bird which got long-legged. You don't have it here in America, but we got a lot of them in Australia.
How did you become a musician?
I was taught by my ancestors. My father and mother taught me how to sing, and that's how I became a good singer and also a dancer.
Do you think that everybody's talented enough to sing, or is it just some people who are actually good enough singers to become singers?
It's mainly my tribe, which I call Chapu, who taught me how to sing and dance, not all the other tribes.
Does everybody in your tribe sing and dance?
Yes.
So when you're singing, are there people who are sitting around and listening, or is everybody singing too?
Everybody's singing, and also everybody's dancing.
So what are some of the times when everybody gets together and sings and dances?
Like, we have some ceremonies which we keep together, as when we make young boys into men, and also when somebody dies. That's the only thing we come together for ceremonies.
What are the songs about when boys become men? But if those are private songs, then I won't want to know.
Sometimes it's private, and sometimes it's just ceremony.
Mm-hmm. Are there songs too private to talk about? Okay,
mm-hmm.
Good. Anthony, when you're setting up concerts, when you're getting musicians to play for white audiences, and it's like outside, it's outside of the tribe, it's outside of the normal setting where people would be playing, what kind of introduction is given to the audiences? I don't know how familiar they are with what they're going to hear.
Well, I must admit that Australians wouldn't be very familiar generally with the real Aboriginal culture. And that's part of the reason that we get some sort of subsidy from the government in this company, because if we left it to commercial interests, we'd probably never get any further. But with the subsidy, we were able to produce concerts in different areas. We might go and, for instance, do a concert for people living in the countryside where perhaps they've never seen Aborigines, and you can easily get the information to people because it can be done in written form or by announcements. But largely, we allow the Aboriginal people themselves to speak about their culture.
Yeah.
Even if it's difficult to understand sometimes, it still makes more impression than being lectured by an expert, so-called expert.
Yeah. John, when you're playing like at a concert, you've played concerts, right? You're on this tour, and then in Australia also you've played concerts?
Yes.
Do you like it better when everybody's singing and dancing when you are, or how do you like it when there's like people in rows of chairs just sitting and listening to you?
I like it better when everybody's singing.
So what do people do at concerts? Sit and listen mostly?
Mm.
What do you try to tell them about the songs that you're going to do? Do you try to tell them what it's about?
Yes, we sometimes do that.
Can I ask you to just sing a little more and play the didgeridoo some more? Tell us a little bit about where you live. It's by the sea, right?
Yeah, I mostly live out of Yirrkala, which is, Yirrkala is a bit of a big area where everybody lives there. And some of us from the northeast of Arnhem Land live out of Yirrkala, which is outstationed from Yirrkala. We call it our homeland centers, and we go there by little MAF. We got our strip there, and also our ancestors stay there, all our old peoples, our mothers and all our grannies, all that, we stay there out of the Yirrkala mission.
So it's mostly your family and your tribe who live in the community.
Yes. And we don't work there as we do in Yirrkala. We just go there hunting, do what we like. Just free life. Like in living before in bushes.
Mm-hmm. Is there much money in the community that changes hands?
No.
Is there any money?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we could go to Yirrkala and work there, if they send us there as young pupils.
Okay. I want to introduce the other two musicians who are with us now, and that's Patty Jangala and Rani Jagamara. And you both live in the desert, yes?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what part of Australia you live in and what life is like there?
Well, it's all desert anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of the area is dry anyway. Now it's very cold up there.
It's cold?
Yeah.
But in your community, it's mostly your tribe who lives there?
Well, some of my family and my relations, you know, and part of my tribe anyway. Then you see that we speak nearly same language in another two community too. And there's another place is south of Lajamanu, that place now where I come from. Another one is east south. Another one is east. Well, we are different tribe. I mean the tribe is, we speak nearly same language, but we're from the different areas, you mm-hmm. know. My tribe is all Wanaka tribes mm-hmm. and Walbury, you know. The Walbury is Wanaka tribes.
Did you all know each other before this tour that you're on now?
No, we're completely from all different tribes.
Uh-huh. Are there things that you really wanted to know about each other's tribes when you got together for this tour?
Well, no, not exactly, because sometimes this up in far north, they just I think it's the capital city of Northern Territory. No? Sometime mm-hmm. we meet there. No?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Can you play some music for us?
Yeah.
Yam yanara la giyana warala jane yam yanara la giyana warala jane yam yanara warala warala jane yam yanara la giyana warala jane yam yanara warala
How did you become a musician and singer?
Well, I was taught when I was about, 15 years old. And I wasn't taught by just, some musician who is very good at it, but just I was taught as everybody being taught, you know. It's the tribes. We carry all the ceremony on and on, you know, as it's been going on from century.
Ronnie, how did you become a musician? Same way? You got taught when you were young how to sing?
Well, I can understand.
Oh,
I guess I can answer for that one. It's very hard for him and all of us, you know, because we just first time from out in the country, you know, like other part of the world, you know.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, actually it's the first time out, you know, and doing things like this, putting in for a radio, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. What? I can understand just a little that, you know, that I can answer some questions and some of them I mightn't answer it because I wouldn't fully understand.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I don't understand any other languages myself, so I know what it's like to not understand another language.
Yeah.
But you're a linguist, aren't you? What are you doing? You're translating your language?
Yeah.
And maybe you can explain what you're doing.
Well, I translate languages. They have linguists in a basin in Darwin, and all over in the Northern Territory, you know, we got languages all over, and they wanted to study it and translate some of the languages, and so that we can able to read and write our own languages too. And I've been with those people for working with them, translating my own languages for 8 years. And by that time, and you know, in other places, I've been far north in Arnhem Land somewhere, you know. Up there, they started off, and they got linguists working there, you know, and they can read and write both of their languages, English and their own languages, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we just started off at Hooker, Lajamano.
I had meant to ask you before what the song that you sang was about.
Oh, it was that was a song about this man. He was broken the law in the tribal things, and Waragang mean they watched him, you know, they followed him, and that the song is meant for that now.
Does
this was Jambayinba.
Excuse me.
Jambayinba. What you call that? The system of a skin system, isn't it?
Yes, part of the kinship system, really.
Yes.
Under which you have strict rules about what your duties are towards the different sections and who you can marry and which people you can talk to.
Yeah. Well, that was the names of one skin system. And that person was Jambayin.
Instruments that you're using are clapsticks.
No. They're boomerang.
Oh, they're boomerangs, really?
Yeah, they're boomerang.
So they're boomerangs that you throw that would come back to you, but you're using them to...
No, I don't know where that come from.
Boomerangs don't really do that?
Yeah, the boomerang that's returned.
Uh-huh.
I don't know where that come from.
Uh-huh.
But what I got here, this boomerang, is the boomerang that... my people use it for hunting games, and also sometimes it's for fighting, you know.
Have they also always been used for music?
Yes, yeah.
Are there different kinds of rhythms that you play for different kinds of music?
Yes.
Can you show us what some of the rhythms are?
Nah.
No?
No.
Okay. That's too personal.
Yes.
Fine. Okay. Let me remember what I wanted to get to now.
Perhaps that's why that culture survived for 200 years since we came there. Because people know what to keep to themselves. It just occurred to me when I was listening to Paddy. You see? You know, they... really, people have spoken so often about how old the culture is, but I personally think that the more remarkable thing is that it survived the last 50 years.
Right.
Not the past 40,000.
Well, do you see things changing a lot amongst the Aboriginals that you work with? Traditions changing or
yes, there's
or
obviously
music?
People who deny that change is taking place are wrong, obviously, and they're only going to... get themselves in a muddle by asserting that things cannot change. But it's a bit presumptuous for Europeans to start saying at what rate things are changing. And in fact, what's actually happening, because most of the time they don't know, even those who are anthropologists told us that the culture would have died out. Those writing in 1950 said perhaps it would die out in 1960. Those writing in 1960 said 1970 and so on. But this is something very mysterious, this culture. And like some of those Indian, American Indian ideas, I think it's going to survive for a lot longer yet. Mm-hmm. In what form, I couldn't say. People certainly are just as flexible. I mean, they're going to start singing songs about airplanes. I mean, they're already doing it. They wrote songs about the Second World War in the areas where they saw the Second World War.
Yeah. Well, John, what are some differences between the old songs and the new songs? Is there a difference?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, it's a bit hard to analyze the differences, but the point is that in 1981, you might be making up a song about... What would you be making up a song about in the recent times? You know, I mean, would you be talking about people driving tractors now at the mining site, or can you think of an example?
Do you write new songs?
Yeah, I do.
What are the new songs about?
Well, we wrote some of the song. One I wrote in my own language is that, you know, like what I have done now, I'm out from the country, and my people and my tribes, you know, and my family, I got wife and kids back home, you know, and they're unhappy when I left them, you know, and they're worried and,
yeah,
you know, this sort of thing. Or somebody goes away and he left his girlfriend or something behind, you know, and he's homesick and he wants to go back. I wrote one of them, but, you know, what making it is very difficult for us is that we didn't read and write like as we are doing it now. You know, we got a few people going to college and all that. Before that, you know, they had to, we couldn't read and write, and we had to talk with the hands and things like that, you know.
But sign now, language. But sign, you mean sign language?
Yeah, sign and hand sign. You know?
Hand sign language. Yeah.
But now we can read and write now, you know.
The song that you were saying that you wrote about someone who leaves his wife and gets very homesick.
Yeah, it's very far, you know.
Could you sing that, or would you rather not?
Well, it's in my own language, one thing, and
that'd sound good.
Yeah,
I'd like to hear it if you wanted to sing it, but if not, I'd understand.
Yeah. Well,
I think it'd be lovely.
Well, it's like that. It's very, very far away. So. Moraku kana lai raro jarimi Wonderu yungu ka nyampu ngolungu nami Munganga kana lau arara yulami Mialu kana lau majulgu nyinami Munganga kana lau arara yulami Mialu ganala majul gunyinami Yangul bani andala ngur ngurara guralgu Yangul bani andala ngaju banda guralgu Munganga ganala warada yulami Mialu ganala majul gunyinami Yungul ban yungala ngachu bandalgu Viyarva yunguka nyinami ngachu wangulgu Agamad kapunnal vinnayani Kabuju vadinye charimi ngachugu Munganga ganala varada yulami mi alo ganala ma julgu ninami monganga ganala warada yulami mi alo ganala ma julgu ninami.
Great.
That's a beautiful song. Do you think your wife also wrote a song about you?
No, we usually sing together, really. She sing with me, too.
Do you get to hear much of other Australian music, either on the radio or in concerts?
Yeah, but what we're thinking now is that some of the songs that are Western way of singing, it's very hard for us to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So that we want to try to write some of our songs, like some of the castles, ceremonies and things like that, like, you know, what with the what you call the creator of the world, you know? Some of the things that as ritual or Aitanam ceremony that we believe in, that the children or the other people would understand that actually the tribe doesn't forget anything. What is the ceremony
mm-hmm.
for the tribe, you know? And the stories.
John, do you ever hear music on the radio or in concerts?
What music?
Rock and roll or country and western music.
Yeah.
Do you like any of it?
Not quite.
Do you think the people who make that music listen to your music and have been changed by what they've heard?
Don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, I was reading in something last night about some Aboriginal rock bands and country and western bands and...
Yes,
I don't know.
It's more in theory than
is it
practice. Yes, I mean, I work with people who. That's really one of the more poignant, horrible things about losing your culture is that you want to get it back again. Perhaps the next generation, perhaps the ones that were happy to live with the television. Their children might, you know, might pine for the thing that's gone, but you can't really put it back unless. You've got your language, and the rock groups really are making up music which sounds more like reggae than ritual. But there's nothing wrong with that. That's just we try to help them to be heard. And but I don't think you could say that there's a resurgence in the culture amongst people who haven't had it for two generations. That's really just fantasy, unfortunately. But must be pretty painful for those that want to get it back.
What does going back mean?
Well, I mean, people who are living in the cities for two generations who feel emotionally that they want to identify with a tribal culture which they've lost. That's a pretty horrific experience, I should think,
mm-hmm.
when you realize that you can't get it.
So there's some, like, people who live in the cities and who are more distant from their culture than, like, the people who are here today who are
with it, yeah.
Who are very, very with it. Do you think that the music is affecting white culture in Australia?
Oh, yes, there's a few. I'm the copyright representative for a lot of traditional Aboriginal work, so there's a few rock bands who like to knock off didgeridoo tracks and start the next, you know, their latest album with a sound. I usually sue them.
Really?
It's very difficult.
Win?
It's very difficult to win because you've got to try and prove where they got the source from and whether that music was copyrighted
mm-hmm.
Or whether, as they say in the music circles, it's just, you know, traditional.
Right. What's the point of suing? What would you hope to
Well, because the people that pay me are the owners and they wish to make the point that these things are not for use on rock bands or whatever you want to do. You know, that people that own the music are to be paid for its use, you know, in the way that it's been done traditionally. Oddly enough, the one thing in our law which intersects with the traditional law is the concept of copyright, because under the old law, the people would negotiate with other tribes to perhaps loan them songs, and I mean they understand the idea of trading elements of ceremony and so forth, but they don't understand the idea of a free-for-all and people making records and then they don't know where it's come from. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a small point. I'm not saying that we have very much success, but...
Right. Patty, do you ever worry that any of your children will leave your community and go to the city? Or do you think that that wouldn't happen?
Oh, well, a lot of people tried. Not many of them, not maybe about 5 or 6 people, or 4. They tried it out, and, you know, they just can't cope with the city life.
What don't they like about it?
Live as a tribal people, with a tribal culture, you know.
If you had the choice, I mean, you don't have the choice, but do you ever wish that you could go back a few generations and live during a time when, like, your tribe was much more isolated from the city and from other cultures, when those choices didn't exist?
You mean have I thinking about going back, or my tribe thinking about going back?
Well, that's not exactly what I meant.
Would you like to have lived in the desert where there were no vehicles and no radios, and like 20 years ago, you know, when there was nobody out there, just like the old people lived?
Not exactly, but it's near enough. Like that, yeah. Because we don't like to go out in the city and things like that, you know. We would go for maybe at least for a day or 2 days. The limit is to a person, for the person to go from there, it's only 3 weeks.
Hmm. It's just that Aboriginal people are much more sophisticated, and they understand that, you know, the spiritual and mental elements of life are the most important, and mm-hmm. whether you've got your clothes on, or whether they're shorts or long trousers or shoes, or whether you're driving a vehicle, doesn't matter two hoots, really. It depends whether you can feel that you're with a body of knowledge and mm-hmm. a community, or whether you feel that you're cut off from it, I suppose. So, I mean, to them, it's not looking at Ian Dunlop's films, for instance, where people have just the simple implements made of wood and are naked. People like ourselves think how different they are from the people we see here today, but of course psychologically they're not very different at all. I think that's possibly the answer.
Mm-hmm. John, can you do a different song for us?
Yes.
You going to do Mokwai or?
No, I'm going to do Big Bird, you haven't got it, or you got it here. Yeah, you got it.
Which
here,
one?
Because I saw one down at Los Angeles at the sea. It's a big, white, big bird.
Seagull.
Yucca. No. It's not seagull, it's a pelican. Yeah.
Is that a new song or an old song?
Nah, just an old song. Just a big pelican looking for his, hunting for his food. That's all there is.
I liked it.
Yeah.
have you thought about what you're going to tell your friends at home when you go back about the United States? About Philadelphia and Los Angeles?
I'm going to tell them a lot of stories, you know. Especially the weather. It's more like it in our place, you know. Very hot. Most of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Same as ours.
What do you think you'll tell people when you go back?
Well, it's very hot up here, and it's cold back home. But it's really strange for us. I mean, the town is so big, and the traffic is so large, you know? And people will think, you know, that's very strange, because where I come from, it's no road much. It's only one way, main road, and small little tracks, you know? Not many of them, because it's dry, and, we don't have large, great, huge roads, you know?
Yeah.
And this is really that, you know, some of my people that they're in this group, yeah, as we came, well, you know, they are really afraid, you know? Even myself, I mean, staying in that international home over there, it's so high. And, you know, it seemed to me, I don't know what Ronnie would feel, but and them others, but some of us feel that, you know, it's strange.
Yeah, it's very different.
Yeah, it's so big, you know, and yeah. We feel that, oh, well, you know, it's the first time, you know, it's first time, and we got to, you know, to other part of the world, and houses and the traffic so complicated, you know. But as we will go on having more and more people, then we'll get along and then understand them. But I couldn't say it's a good thing or a bad thing, but, you know, it's so strange for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of my people are thinking it's so strange. Yeah.
Sounds really disorienting, Anthony. Do you think everybody was prepared for how different it was going to be? And
no, but they're a lot more resilient than most of us, you see.
Yeah.
Tougher.
Uh-huh.
So,
what do you see as being the benefits for the people on the tour and for the people coming to see them perform?
Well, the people on the tour all come from the one organization. It's called the Aboriginal Cultural Foundation, and it's based in Darwin. And it's a big organization with a lot of their representatives from tribal groups, and so that's why they met each other before, because they live so far apart. But the idea was that for the first time, a tour such as this would allow people to control some of the aspects of the tour, to control the selection of the people. So there were a lot of benefits before they actually set out from Australia. Mm-hmm. The process of getting prepared, of choosing who to come and what to present, is something that people took over themselves for the first time. And as for those, I don't know exactly what the benefits of America are versus going to somewhere else. I think that's a bit hard to tell, except that they've heard a lot about America. I mean, in Australia, we have television and we have radio, and we have a lot of the things you're advertising industries move over there. I mean, people want to get to the background of these things. I think that's interesting for them personally, but I can't be sure. And here, I think people should know that such powerful, simple ideas can sustain people and a culture for a long time. That's really the idea of the tour, is that it's not just an entertainment, it's just to show people living in this big materialist metropolis that you can survive in a totally different way, perhaps quite adequately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there are enough people in America interested. One thing about your population is that they at least explore alternatives. And there are good, open-minded people here who would be who have come to our concerts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much. I want to thank you very much for talking with us and for sharing some of your music. I really appreciate it. Thank you. I hope you have a good trip too.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The Big Apple.
Yeah. you going to New York?
Yes.
That'll be real interesting. I grew up there. My whole family is from New York. But probably a different part that, from the part that you're going to be in.
Can I say something? Well, you know, we used to, I mean, we live in a small area, no? And now our thinking is that, you know, we don't want to talk about a thing that we haven't been there, you know? So it's how thinking is that we want to know what's happening in another part of the world.
Yeah.
So that the people can know, you know? Because, you know, we were, you know, thinking, well, do we have to go or we stop, you know? And then the tribe, you know, got together and said, oh, you know, we want to know what exactly people are doing, or, I mean, what's happening in another part of the world, you know?
Yeah.
So we're going to go back and we won't be ready to know everything exactly, you know, but and maybe next time or something like that, then, you know, we'll just know a little bit about it, right? Because, you know, coming around halfway around the world, it's really strange.